We're so lucky to have a real diversity of wildlife here in the state. There's something to watch for and marvel in every season, isn't there? And fall is certainly no exception. In fact, it's one of the great times of the year to be outside to see our wildlife. Larry Mueller here. David Drake is a wildlife specialist with UW Extension and an associate professor in the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at UW-Madison. One of our guests, David, great to have you with us again.
Well, Larry, thank you for having us on the show.
Jamie Knack, Wildlife Outreach Specialist with the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology with us as well, and great to have you back.
Great. It's nice to be back again. Thanks, Larry.
We have lots of good things that we can talk about today. One thing, though, that is sort of on the serious side in a way is the drought, and wondering what effect that drought has had on our wildlife here in Wisconsin. David, you want to start?
Yeah, we have had a bit of a dry summer, especially the last half of the summer, and thankfully here in the Madison area, at least we've gotten some rain this week, has helped us out some. But it has been on the dry side, and that certainly affects wildlife. Last summer as well, we had a pretty serious drought, and we got quite a few calls and emails that from people saying that they have never seen so many wildlife, you know, around their yards as they had last summer, and to some extent this summer. And, you know, when it's dry out there, animals need water to survive, and they can go a lot longer without food than they can water. And so in drought years, obviously, we are watering our lawns to try to keep our lawns alive and our plantings and things like that. And so the animals see that water, and they're attracted to it for their own water requirements. And,
sure.
And will come in a lot closer to houses than perhaps they might during a non-drought year. So that certainly is one of the effects it has on animals.
Should we be providing water? I'm telling you, I looked out on my bird feeder, our watering feeder that we have for the birds. What am I trying to say here?
The bird bath.
Bird bath. Good grief, Larry. The bird bath.
We got a long shell left, Larry.
Yeah, I know. I'm going to have to wake up a little bit here or something. I don't know. Anyway, there's a squirrel in the bird bath, which I had never seen a squirrel in our bird bath. And
yeah.
So I'm wondering, is there a safe and effective way to provide water for wildlife? The bird bath certainly has been for insects and birds, and now I see squirrels.
So I want to step one a little bit shy of saying it can't hurt. There are some things you want to be careful about when you do supply water, making sure that it's fresh, it's replenished. So something as small as a bird bath, you want to refreshen that water every day or so.
Yep.
Ponds and things like that, if it's getting pretty stagnant, having a filtration system or aerating it will certainly help to keep it clean and fresh. That's important. And then the other thing, yes, you could take even a small plastic swimming pool and fill it with just a couple inches of water at the bottom. But the concern here, or something you need to be mindful of, is to put some sort of structure within that pool so that the animal can get back out. So whether you leave a log in there or something like that so that the animal doesn't get completely wet and can't climb up the side. So, but yeah, certainly you can help animals out by adding that additional water source.
And, you know, you wonder if that drought continues and, you know, let's say we have lower than usual snowfall. That could have an impact as well, I would.
Well, some of the current, you know, concerns, I guess, with the drought, and certainly we saw this last year too, is that immediately some of the habitat requirements for the animals, whether that's food or shelter, we see a reduction of plant growth, and that can be a reduction of hiding places and places for them just to find suitable cover to avoid predation. But also it can mean there's less fruit. The animal or the plant produces less fruit and just less food sources in general, fewer acorns in a given year, and even water sources. If we don't have water sources, we don't have insect populations, and some of the bats could be going into hibernation or migration with fewer fat reserves.
Yeah,
and that's certainly an issue right now. We've got a lot of animals are starting to migrate out of our area, primarily birds, and we've got a lot of animals that are gearing up for winter if they're going to stay here in our state, and they're either going to hibernate or they're going to, you know, be active but ride the whole winter out, and all of those animals need to put on a pretty good layer of fat and nutrition right now so they can either get south where they need to go or they can enter hibernation with a good layer of fat and things like that. And you know, one other issue I'll just mention quickly about the snow layer is not only does that replenish water sources and things like that, but that snow is very, very important for animals that hibernate because that snow acts as a thermal cover. And we don't really think about that because snow is cold.
Yeah.
But once those animals burrow under the ground and that snow lays down, that acts as almost a blanket and it keeps them warm. And in winters when we have either little snow or no snowfall at all, those animals that are hibernating, especially underground, really struggle because it gets much, much colder for them.
Talking today with David Drake and Jamie Knack about our Wisconsin wildlife, and certainly inviting you to join in with your questions and comments or maybe your experiences that you have to share. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org or go to my Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. You can post a photo of your own, a wildlife photo, and certainly post questions there. Judith Sears Poisson, our producer, was on a pheasant hunting experience that she'll be explaining later, but I wanted to just point it out now that she posted a number of pictures. She was in the Learn to Hunt program this last weekend and has a bunch of photos of her in that Learn to Hunt pheasant program, which is pretty cool. So go to the Facebook page and post a question, take a look at Judith's pictures. And again, call us at 1-800-642-1234. Fall hunting season gearing up, and the DNR is encouraging hunters to submit their field observations of deer. Why is that important?
Well, there's going to be, and bow hunting or archery deer season has already started, and we know that hunters spend a lot of time in the woods, in the fields, sitting in their stands quietly, patiently waiting for deer or other pursuits. Turkey is open now as well. And during that time, they observe a lot of other wildlife. But what the state is interested in collecting from hunters is the number of deer that they're seeing per hour hunted, the counties, the deer management units that they're in, the weather conditions. So a lot of information as far as deer goes, but also additional species or sightings of more rare mammals and birds, they're very much interested in as well. And there's a data form that you can fill out online or print and mail in if you see animals like badgers or bears or bobcats or just any animal that is unusual for your specific area of the state. And again, that's how we know both through wildlife biologist sightings and also the public reporting sightings. That's how we know that we have badgers in every county of the state. Although we don't have an idea of their relative abundance, we can start to get ideas of just distribution and where they're occurring and follow trends in range expansion and so on.
And the DNR has, and I just liked the page myself, a Facebook page on kind of for hunters or people who are interested in the out-of-doors, photos and a place to share and exchange information.
Yeah, they're also interested in trail camera pictures, which the use of trail cameras has just exploded in the state. I mean, we get pictures asking for help with identification or folks we know that are just sharing some really neat pictures of animals in the field. But that too, if you have camera pictures, you can submit those to the DNR's trail camera gallery. And you can also take a look at those pictures that others have submitted of could be a cougar, could be badgers, moose, things like that are more unusual animals for the state.
Really a lot of fun to see, aren't they, David?
Yeah, they sure are. We just, end of August, conducted a forest landowner workshop through the coverts program with the Rough Grouse Society, and we always put trail cams out and teach the cooperators or the participants how to use trail cams as a monitoring tool for wildlife on their land. And for the first time ever up at Camp Natural Resource Station, we caught a bobcat on the trail camera. And so that was really exciting to see that.
That is wonderful. And you mentioned forest. And that reminded me of something else that we've got that just came out. There's some emergency funds available to replace drought-killed tree seedlings. And this is, you may not have even seen the article, but it was landowners who've experienced a significant loss in trees. And it would be trees that they planted between 2008 and 2012. You might be eligible to receive a grant for replanting those trees that were lost and under the Wisconsin Forest Landowner Grant Program. Emergency funds have been designated again this year for tree planting failures of greater than 25% due to the 2012 drought. So
That's encouraging. And it looks like the link for the tree replacement is up on your Facebook page, Larry, yep. for people want to pursue that.
As always, Judith has got it posted. So if, go to my Facebook page, you can get more information. There's quite a bit more information out there about it. But, why not?
That's
take
right.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Ann in Madison has a question. Hi, Ann.
Hi. I just was wondering about bats. We've had bats in our house here in Madison for a couple weeks. Now, we haven't had them now for 2 weeks, but we had them for a couple weeks almost every day, and there would be two of them flying around in our house, and we'd have to catch them with a fish net and let them outside. And then we also had them at the cabin, which is about 50 miles north of here. And I was wondering, do they migrate, or do they hole up somewhere in a space in your attic, or what can you tell me about that?
Anne, that's a very good question, and I'll say starting out, it depends. We have had, historically, 8 bat species in the state of Wisconsin, but currently we have 7 remaining bat species. The 8th was the federally endangered Indiana bat. And that, if it was in our state, it has not been seen since the 1960s, early 1960s. And if it still was in our state, it would be confined to the extreme southern reaches of Wisconsin. So for all intents and purposes, we have 7 bat species remaining in the state of Wisconsin. 3 of those bat species are what we call migratory tree roosting bats. And so those bats are starting to migrate out of our state now, and they'll go south. Into the United States, and they'll be active year-round in the warmer climates during the winter. So that would be the eastern red bat, the hoary bat, and the silver-haired bat. We have 4 bat species that are resident bat species, and the bats that you probably have in both your house in Madison and in your cabin up north is most likely the big brown bat, which is one of our 4 state resident species. And so we've got big brown, little brown, northern myotis, and eastern pipistrelle are the four species that stay in our state year-round. Because all bats are insectivores, they're insect eaters, that means that the 4 species in our state that are resident species, when the insects are not available in the winter, that those bats have to hibernate if they're going to survive. And so they start exploring areas for hibernation, one of which can be your house, attics and crawl spaces and things like that. And so it's most likely the big brown bat that you were seeing, because those are the most common species, or that's the most common species that will hibernate in people's houses. And so essentially what's happening when you're catching that bat and releasing it, unless you seal up the access point into your house, you're releasing it, and it's this big game. You catch it, release it, it comes back in the next day. You catch it, release it, it's going to come back in, unless you seal up that access point. And bats only need about a half of an inch gap or so to be able to get into attics and houses and things like that. So
size of a dime or so.
Yeah, something like that, even a little bit smaller. And some of these older houses, after they've settled, there are so many cracks, both in the house and the foundation and the eaves and fascia boards and things like that. It's almost impossible to keep bats out of the house. But the one thing I will say, and again, it's not cause for alarm, but certainly bats can carry a number of diseases, rabies being the one that's most common, or I shouldn't say most common, but that people probably are most aware of. And so in your house, you just want to make sure that if you have a bat flying around while you're sleeping, and especially if you're active, you just need to be really careful that you don't get bit or scratched by that bat. And if you do, you need to make sure that you catch that bat and kill it and submit it to the county health department for testing. Otherwise, you're going to have to go through the rabies series, and that's not the most enjoyable thing to do. Mm-hmm. And it can be expensive.
Yeah, expensive. It's not as bad as it used to be.
No, it's not, but it's still not fun.
Still not fun, and something that can be quite expensive. Yep. Anne, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. And just as a related question, Tyler in Park Falls has a related thing we should probably take, too. Tyler?
Yeah. We're in Park Falls, and we're going to be renovating an old farmhouse. And as of right now, the ceiling has a lot of bats in it that, once we redo it, they're going to not have that place to go. So we'll be adding, a bat house in the area to give them kind of an alternate place to go. And we're just wondering if there's any places that help with that, the designing of them, or, financially helping with it, mm-hmm. To protect the bats and give them that alternate place to go.
Well, that's a great question, Tyler. So the best location to go when you're looking for either bat house plans or even to purchase a bat house, I'd like to refer you to Bat Conservation International. And their website is bcicon.org. And they have designs on how to build your own bat house with multiple chambers, so some different sized plans, depending on how large of a house you'd like to build. They also have some really helpful fact sheets on how to properly place a bat house. The recommendation is to place it on a pole as being the best place to put it. And then also they have information you could purchase bat houses through them. I know you can also find bat houses in local nature centers, bird food stores, and things like that. But just be careful that you're purchasing a house. I would recommend looking for one that's been BCI approved or certified, because they've been rigorously tested and are more likely to be successful in attracting the bats. And then also just to make people aware, and I'm sure you're already aware of this, but there is a new law that does not allow homeowners to evict bats or disturb bats from June. I think it's June 1st through August 15th. And that is because that is when they have the females have their young. So if you evict the adults, you're essentially leaving those young behind, and they will die because they're a mammal and they need to nurse. They need the mother. So there's a time window there where you cannot do that excluding of the bats in the home. But otherwise, early spring into the fall before they start hibernating are certainly times and windows of opportunities to deal with bats in your home. And the reason for that protection is because of their threatened status, because of the threat of white nose syndrome in our state.
Yep. There you go. Good luck, Tyler. Thank you very much for calling. You were going to add something, David.
I was just going to mention also that we've got some very, very good bat ecologists with the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, and they're also a very good resource. If you want to contact them, they may have resources that are in your area that can also help you with bat relocation.
And thanks again for calling. Appreciate it. David Drake and Jamie Knack of the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at UW-Madison, our guests today. I'm Larry Mueller. Judith Sears Poisson, our producer on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here with my two guests, David Drake and Jamie Knack of the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at UW-Madison, talking about the wildlife here in our state. And I'm certainly inviting you to join us at 1-800-642-1234 with your questions. You can email us at talk@wpr.org, or you can go to my Facebook page, post a question and a photo there at the Larry Mueller Show. So we'd certainly love to hear from you. And Mike in Madison has a question. Mike, hi, thank you for calling.
Yeah, I actually live in Milton, and when we first moved to town there was a cougar or mountain lion sighting that came through the state. It was pretty much covered by all the news. I'm just wondering, is there still any of those species in our state, and how much are there?
All right. So do we have any mountain lions in the state right now? Right?
First of all, hi, Mike. That's a good question. I don't know that we have, I'm not aware of a cougar sighting currently in the state. There was one, I think, this past summer. I'm not sure how well publicized that was, Jamie.
Yeah, I would hazard a guess that there's certainly the likelihood that there's a cougar in our state right now, whether we are currently detecting it and tracking it or not. Through the last couple of years, we've documented at least six different individual cougars. They've all been juvenile males. They've been genetically tested and then tracked back to the Black Hills population of cougars in South Dakota. So that's where they're coming from. The reason they're coming is that population often, they're territorial, and the males will defend their own territory, home range. So they have breeding opportunities with the females. And these young males get pushed out and have to go and look for suitable habitat and females within the area to set up new territories. And we have started to see exploratory movements of young males, and they've passed through the state. What we don't have is any documentation of any female cougars, which means that the possibility of breeding at this point is not possible. And females typically do not move as far as males do. So it's not to say that decades from now that's not possible, but right now there's been no females in the state. So all of our documented cougar movements have been very transient. They get documented moving through the state, and then we lose track of that animal. It goes into another state, into Canada, or so on. So they're not likely to stay in one place for very long because they're not finding females.
But I'll just add one comment to that, and I agree with everything Jamie said. The neatest cougar story that has happened in Wisconsin for decades was the one that cougar came into our state in December and in January of 2009, 2010. And again, it came out of the South Hills population in South Dakota, or Black Hills population in South Dakota, came around the Minneapolis-St. Paul, across the St. Croix River, and then it came into Wisconsin, and then they lost it. And then that same cougar got killed in June of 2010, about 6 months later, about 30 miles west of the Atlantic Ocean in Connecticut.
Yeah, it's amazing.
And it was incredible. And they were able to track it because they could track the genetics of that cougar as it moved across and dropping scat. And once the cougar got killed by the car, obviously they had the animal. But that was the longest straight line distance movement of a cougar in North America ever recorded. And that's a pretty phenomenal story.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and for the listeners that are interested in following cougar sightings and observations, the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources website, if you just Google or search for cougar sightings, they will track any current sightings and put it up on the website so you can see what's been observed either through trail cameras or tracks or scat or so on.
Yeah, but they're a native species and they belong in Wisconsin. So it's pretty neat that they're starting to come back.
Caller Steve said that he saw his first cougar on the east side of Madison a few weeks ago. He also wonders what the relationship between cougars and a fox.
Now, on the east side of Madison, we're talking about cougar, the wildlife species, not the 40-year-old woman, right? So is that correct?
Yeah, as he's saying, on the east side. So it could have been any, well, I mean, there's marsh and swamp and so forth, but I'd like to see some proof of that.
That would be helpful. They are often misidentified for animals like Fisher. Even a house cat at seen from a distance, folks have a hard time looking at proportions. Or a bobcat. Somebody's never seen a bobcat. Maybe you don't see the tail and misidentify it. He was asking about the relationship between cougars and fox, and really they're in two different families. The cougar is a member of the cat family, more closely related to the bobcat, and then the fox is in the dog family. We have red and gray fox in the state, and then coyotes and wolves in that family.
I was remembering someone calling and saying that they had locked a cougar in a mountain lion in their barn, and somebody from the DNR, I think some people went out to check, and it was just a large house cat.
Right.
Those orange tabbies get them every time.
So it's possible. You know what? Here we are. He actually called back and said, he didn't mean cougar, it was a coyote.
Yeah, and that is very common.
That is very common.
Throughout Madison and the state, so... And that is a much more common sighting than cougar, for sure.
And a coyote and a fox
are related.
Are related.
Yes.
So, correct.
So there we go. We got that straightened out. You guys have you like to throw a quiz out. And here we've got another quiz today for you as you listen in today. And we're going to pick a winner at random from all the correct answers. And that person is going to receive a pretty nice prize here. It's like almost 450-page book. It's called The Warbler Guide. We interviewed the authors not long ago. Thousands of pictures to identify the warblers, all of the warblers that you would ever see in the United States. Very cool. And Tom Stevenson and Scott Whittle are the two authors from that. We talked with them last month. Really a gorgeous and very useful guide. So we can email your answer to talk@wpr.org. So go to talk@wpr.org, put quiz, the word quiz in the subject line, and also include your first and last name and where you live in the message. You can also call 1-800-642-1234 with your answer, but you may run into some busy phone lines, so that's a problem. So here's the question. Being able to identify a wildlife by sight is one skill, but being able to do it by sound is another. So let's see how good you are. I'm going to play an audio clip. Your job is to see what creature makes that sound. We're going to give you, let's say, 10 minutes to get your answer in. So let me get myself set up here. So what creature makes this sound? All right, so I give you plenty of, let's do it once more just for fun. I would venture to say that a lot of people will have heard this sound.
Absolutely.
Yeah, for sure.
And might not know what it is. So, there you go. We will, so you have, you got about 10 minutes to email us at talk@wpr.org. Put quiz in the subject line, your first and last name, and where you live in the message. You can also call 1-800-642-1234 with your answer. But you may run into some busy phone lines, so that would be a problem. Let's go to Tom in Powers Lake. Tom, thank you for calling.
Nice to talk to you, Larry.
Thanks for calling.
I have, just within the past couple of weeks, two different groundhog or... beside the house, and I mean the dirt is up 3 feet high. And I had this problem about 10 years ago and haven't seen any in my property for the last 10 years. And suddenly I have two different tunnels, both close to the foundation of the house, one on the south side and one on the east side. And I've only seen animals going in the one tunnel. That was a large one, bigger than a house cat, a lot heavier, and then a small one. And on the south side of the house, I haven't really seen any animals. How do I get rid of them?
Well, Tom, thanks for calling. And just to verify that we are actually talking about a groundhog, or these animals are also called woodchucks, or occasionally you'll hear them referred to as whistle pigs as well. But groundhog and woodchuck are the same animal, and they will certainly dig holes into the ground, and the hole can be maybe a foot and a half or 2 feet or so in diameter, something like that, with dirt mounded up or soil mounded up in front of at least one of the holes. But there are another, there's another animal out there, the badger, that can also dig holes like that. And typically, badger holes will have scatter or, droppings in front of the, hole. And they usually will have also, some remains of their dinner. And you can sometimes have fox or coyote are digging the holes as well, but you're relatively certain it's a groundhog.
Right.
Okay.
Okay.
So there's a number of ways to take care of them, one of which is to use gas cartridges, and essentially you would gas the burrow and euthanize the animal with the gas. However, because it sounds like those burrows are next to your house and perhaps under your house, it's not advisable to use gas, just in case that gas seeps through the soil and then seeps into your house. And so the next best alternative probably is to get a large-sized live trap, either a tomahawk or havihard, or the more common live traps. Bait it with apple, and you would just take that apple and either quarter it or half it, or you could bait it with plum tomatoes or something like that. And you want to open that trap and put the open trap with the bait next to the hole that's got the largest mound of soil in front of it. That's their primary entrance. But as you've indicated correctly, animals that live underground, they're called fossorial. Those animals have multiple entrances open into their burrows, so that if something happens, they can quickly get out of the burrow or they can get back into the burrow. And so what you'd want to do is set that trap next to the hole or the opening with the largest soil mound. And then also, if you will cover that trap either with a piece of old burlap or blanket or towel or something like that, that assimilates the darkness of the burrow, and it'll make the animal feel a lot more comfortable going into that trap. And within, let's say, 24 hours or so, you should have that groundhog. Now, one other quick thing about the trapping, and then we'll talk about what to do once you've got the animal. Groundhogs are diurnal. They're active during the day. So if you will open that trap first thing in the morning and close it, once the sun starts going down, you will avoid catching raccoons and skunks and possums and your neighbor's cat and things like that. Now, once you've got the animal, you've got a couple of choices. You are legal to kill the animal if you wish to. And how you choose to do so is your own business, as long as the way you do it is legal in the township you live and it's humane to the animal. You are also able and legal to release the animal if you want to. And if you do that, I would go at least 5 miles or so from your property where you've caught it. But if you release the animal on private property you don't own, you need that permission of the property owner. And if you release it on public land, it's advisable to get to the permission of the public land manager.
Well, there you go. And I see at one point, 1 year, I trapped 11.
Whoa, that's a lot.
Yeah, so I've had a lot of experience with it, and your directions are perfect.
Well, thank you.
That's what worked for you as well, huh?
Thanks, Tom. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Jerry in La Crosse, hi.
Hi, thanks. I'm interested in wolverines. I wonder if we have any wolverines. I believe we used to have some in Wisconsin. And I think they have some in the Upper Peninsula, or at least they do in Michigan. My understanding is a wolverine can easily kick the butt of a badger. Am I right?
Easy there.
Well, I don't know. Yeah, we're infringing on Bucky here. So, well, thanks for the question, Jerry. Wolverines were a native animal, or still are a native animal to the state, but they are coined as extirpated. And the word extirpated is a term used for an animal that was once native to an area and then was wiped out, or the population's diminished to the point that there aren't any more. So it's been over 100 years since we've had a documented sighting of a wolverine in the state of Wisconsin. So they are considered an extirpated animal. And you're correct, Upper Peninsula of Michigan, occasionally there are sightings. And they are an animal that needs large contiguous blocks of habitat to survive. And at the time of European settlement and some of those landscape changes that occurred in the state, their populations diminished as a result of some of that. But Montana and other places, they still do exist.
Mm-hmm. There you go. Thanks for calling. Terry in Green Bay, hello.
Yes, good morning. I'd just like to make a couple comments, please. You were discussing water for the wildlife earlier in the show,
yeah.
And I wouldn't have a bird bath without a dripper system.
Yeah, that's a good idea. And typically we recommend, if you put some kind of a human-provided water source, be it a landscape pond or a bird bath out there, that if you can create some movement in the water, either by dripping water or trickling water or something of that nature, a fountain, something like that, that seems to attract the animals more so than a stagnant water source. And it will also keep the water a little bit cleaner because it aerates it. And in the wintertime, it will also keep the ice from freezing on that water. And we don't really talk too much about water in the winter, but that is one of the times that water is a limiting factor, because it's either bound up in ice or it's covered up by snow. So if you can provide an open source of water in the winter for those birds that need that water and they can find it, that would be very beneficial to them.
Yeah, and could I make a comment on mounting of windows?
Sure.
Okay. I know Larry had a guest on a good year or so ago, and he was talking about, like, when you're putting either new windows, replacing windows in your home, or you're building a new home or something, chip the top of your windows outward to stop as much reflection as possible to avoid collisions with birds.
Yep.
Yeah, thanks, Terry. That's an excellent solution step to take to avoid window collisions.
Yeah, it's absolutely. And thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. And we have, an email from Donna. She says she's successfully, this is getting rid of groundhogs. She said she's used really nasty kitty litter. She dumps copious amounts of it into the hole, and the groundhogs don't like it. Of course, it may need renewal after a while, but she says it does work, and I guess it'd be worth a try.
Well, you know, there are a lot of folksy remedies out there for getting rid of issues with wildlife. And we've got a friend of ours who, you know, recommends, one of his recommendations is flushing the hole of chipmunks with water and flushing them up onto the ground. Some of these things will work. But if you think about efficiency and effectiveness, you know, for example, trapping is a pretty effective and very efficient method relative to throwing kitty litter down the hole, and you don't have to keep refreshing the kitty litter and things like that. So it may work, but there also are some better solutions out there.
Brian in Milwaukee, hi, thanks for calling.
Hi, I had a question about red squirrels. I've noticed more red squirrels in the Milwaukee area than I have in the past. I always thought they were a northern Wisconsin breed. And I'm wondering if that's accurate or if that's just my imagination. And when they do have contact with the gray squirrels, does one breed dominate or do they live together more or less peacefully?
Brian, I'm going to just throw out a guess here. But the red squirrels, they are in southern Wisconsin. It's more of a issue of habitat. So it's my understanding they're more of a coniferous species as opposed to the gray and fox squirrel that are more of a deciduous type preference for habitat. So while they are probably more concentrated in northern Wisconsin, certainly in the central forests and in southeast where you are in the Milwaukee area, it's not uncommon to have red squirrels in those specific types of habitat.
No. Oh. Very good. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. And we have lots of callers online. We got a winner as well. We'll announce that winner in just a minute. I'm Larry Mueller. My guests today, David Drake and Jamie Knack from the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at UW-Madison and UW Extension. Our guests here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking about the world of wildlife today with our two guests, David Drake and Jamie Knack from the UW Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology. Great to have them along. Thank you so much for listening in. And we had a test. Well, we had a little contest, actually, a little quiz, where we asked you to identify the sound that this thing made. And I'm going to play it once more. Or should I give the answer first? Maybe we should give the answer.
Give the answer first. That's a good idea, actually.
Okay, so the correct answer is?
The eastern chipmunk.
The eastern chipmunk. So here it is. And so we had people guessing bats and squirrels and a few other things, insects, I think, some insects. But the winner, Maggie C. in Pound, Wisconsin, Judith Sears Poisson joining us, she guessed it.
She did. She got it right.
And so Maggie, we're going to be sending you a copy of the Warbler Guide, 450 pages on warblers. And
I was actually afraid people were going to get thrown because it was a bird guide. And a few people did guess cardinal, but for the most part, people were pretty close. Lots of squirrel guesses.
Well, Judith, you took part in a Learn to Hunt event this past weekend.
It was not Learn to Hunt Chipmunk, but.
No, but it was focused on pheasants.
It was.
So maybe you could tell us a little about that experience.
Sure. First of all, I want to thank Jamie, especially. She and Scott Craven sat down. They knew that I was interested in learning to hunt. I did not grow up in a hunting family. And I think when you're an adult and that's not part of the culture that you grow up in, it's hard to know where to jump in. And it's at least for me, it was more than a little intimidating thinking about jumping in. So Jamie and Scott sat down and mapped out all these great things. Keith Warnke, who was also on a few weeks ago, was more than happy to help. And this was good timing. And it seemed like, you know, might as well do it sooner rather than later. So I went, it was held at the McKenzie Environmental Education Center up in Poinette, and folks from the Poinette Game Farm were there on hand, and then lots of people that volunteered their time to be mentors, to be trainers, to just be on hand, to answer questions. it was a wonderful experience. It was overnight. We got there about 1 o'clock on Saturday, left about 2 o'clock on Sunday, stayed in the dorms. This was a general Learn to Hunt weekend, so a lot of the people participating as new hunters were a lot of young boys, but there were also people like me, neither young nor boys. and it was great. And the educational parts were so interesting. They included gun safety. It wasn't the whole gun safety class, obviously. That's usually, I think, 15 or 16 hours, but a gun safety introduction, pheasant biology and behavior. We also had conservation wardens come in and talk to us about what their job is and how they're really there to support the vast majority of hunters who are very ethical and follow the rules, that they aren't the bad guys. They're actually the good guys. I thought that was especially important for the young people there to learn. We had an amazing demonstration of hunting dogs, both flushers and pointers. And then we also got practice shooting air rifles at targets, trap shooting. That was the first time I'd ever held or fired a gun, and it was lots of fun. And no, I didn't hit anything, but you know, that's okay. Everyone was so supportive and helpful. It was a really great experience. So that was mostly on Saturday. On Sunday, which, as many of you might remember, was extremely rainy, we went out on mentored hunts. And so every new hunter had a mentor assigned to him or her. Two new hunters, their mentors, and then a dog handler and dog went out for about an hour at a time. They have several different fields available at the McKenzie Center, and so it was all very safe. The mentors were really there to make sure that safety was first. Now, it was so wet that the birds were not flying, but that was okay. I felt very rugged walking through, for me, almost shoulder-high grass, because I'm on the shorter side, you know, in the rain and out there with the dog and everything. It was a really great experience. And then because there weren't enough fields or mentors available at a single time for everyone to be out hunting at the same time, the group was basically divided in half. And while some were hunting, the rest went and visited the Poinette Game Farm and saw where all of the pheasants are raised, saw the ancient machinery that they use, the incubators, I think from 1932. It was like a time capsule, except it was a functioning time capsule, and saw all the birds and learned that they're releasing many more birds this year, which I know David and Jamie are going to mention. So we got to see really the whole thing. And I felt like, as someone who really has not been very familiar with the whole hunting culture, I learned so much and developed even more of an appreciation of the tradition and you know, watching grandpas passing along information and their love of hunting to their grandsons who were there. It was a great experience. And so I came home with a bird, even though it was too wet for the birds to be flying. Our dog got a little excited and brought one back to us. So I came home with a pheasant without actually having to shoot my gun.
And it is pretty tasty, I gotta say.
It is excellent.
Yeah, Judith brought in what she made, or a bit of what she made.
One of two dishes. So I used the pheasant breasts to do that in a mustard sauce with onions and garlic and a little lemon, and that was quite good. That didn't make it in because that got inhaled. I served that over brown rice. And then what I brought in for David and Jamie and Larry to try is I stewed the legs with carrots and onions and garlic and celery, cooked it for a couple hours, and then took the meat out to shred, and then threw some wild rice in and cooked that to soak up all the pheasant broth. And I'm hearing that it was very good.
Lots of flavor.
Good.
Very good.
For me, you know, as someone who really wanted to learn and wanted to gain more of an appreciation and just a knowledge base, but having no experience at all, this was a perfect way to do it. And I so appreciate all the people that volunteer their time to do it. And I have to say, I mean, the price, you can't beat it. There was a $10 deposit, and then they gave it back to you there. So, and they fed us, you know, lunch, dinner, and then breakfast the next morning. But, you know, there's a real commitment to keeping those numbers of hunters up for conservation reasons and all kinds of reasons. And this is a great way to do it.
And there are Learn to Hunt programs for not only pheasants, but for deer and
turkey.
Turkey.
There's Learn to Hunt, deer, turkey, bear. My husband at the farm is also going to be doing a learn to raccoon hunt in November that has a limited sign up, I think 20, so that might be a possibility. But if you're interested in any of these opportunities, the Department of Natural Resources website, again, search under learn to hunt and you'll see those opportunities for those programs, but also hunter education courses. So if you do want to go through the complete program and get certified, these are kind of one-time deals. So you can do a learn to pheasant hunt. And you can do some of the other species, but you can't repeat for the same species. So, yeah.
And one of the things I was really impressed by was there were, especially the adults that were there with the younger new hunters, a lot of them had been hunting for, you know, 20, 30 years, but they had never hunted pheasants. And they were so interested and engaged in learning themselves about what makes this particular animal different to hunt. And it was just really great to see people who have tons of experience still being so open to learning and feeling like they were really getting a lot out of it.
Yeah. Judith, thank you.
Of course.
And she has posted on my Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show a number of photos from her experience. And Go to the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page and you can take a look at those photos. A lot of fun. There's some of Judith shooting away. And
yeah, it's pretty dang neat.
Yeah, it's very, very neat. And something that you might want to consider getting involved in. We have callers online with questions and comments. Nick in Green Bay has something. Let's go there. Nick, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. I got a small problem. I called the city and they don't want to do anything about it. We got two turkeys in the backyard. And the other day, they're getting bolder and bolder. Well, the other day we were sitting on the couch and all of a sudden I saw a head pop up in the front door window. I hear the turkeys looking inside the house, which isn't so bad. I mean, I don't mind that. The other problem is I got a four-year-old and she thinks the turkeys are great, so she tried to chase them. And they don't want to back down at all because it's a mother and offspring.
Yeah.
Any suggestions? Because I heard they can be kind of nasty.
Well, Nick, that's a good question, and that is not an uncommon problem these days. Turkeys are a very adaptable species, as we're finding out, and they do quite well in suburban areas and people's backyards and things like that. I will mention that we have a website, and the website is wildlifedamage.uwex.edu. So wildlifedamage.uwex.edu. And on that website, which is a collaborative effort between Wisconsin Extension, Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, and the United States Department of Agriculture and Wildlife Services, we have a fact sheet on there about how to manage turkeys from a damage situation, which is what you have here. So a couple of things you can do, but one thing is, obviously, if your daughter's out there with those turkeys and if they're not backing down, you do need to be a little bit careful about that because they can charge and they may knock her down. And the toms or the male turkeys can be even more aggressive, and they've got spikes on their the back of their legs, and those spikes sometimes can be used, and that can be a little bit dangerous. But if you can go out there with your daughter, or maybe another adult could go out with your daughter, and if they don't back down from a bigger person, if you want to take a broom or something like that and start shooing them away, or take your garden hose and spray a steady stream of water at them or something like that. But the more unpleasant you can make it for them when they're in your yard, the less time they're going to actually spend in your yard. So that's one possibility. The other thing, if they're actually starting to look in the windows or the doors and the glass, they're starting to see the reflection. If you can break that or the reflection up or eliminate that reflection, that's one less thing that they're going to come in towards your house for. So there's some other suggestions in that fact sheet you might want to take a look at as well, but those would be the two that I think would be immediate that you might want to try.
And when you say adaptable, boy, they certainly are. And I'm thinking back as you were talking, I've played on several golf courses in Wisconsin here over this last summer, and almost every course I played on, I saw turkeys.
Yeah, they are everywhere.
I mean, they were, I think, all but maybe one course I saw turkeys.
Yep. It's they're becoming like deer and Canada geese and some other species in that suburban environment that are increasing in numbers, and they're becoming more and more difficult to manage.
Barbara in Gotham, thanks for calling. Hi.
Hi, Larry. I'm a big fan of your shows, and I have gotten some really good information in the past. So I'm looking for advice. I've got a problem around my foundation of my home in Gotham. It's kind of a little tiny little village. And they're digging something, a critter. I haven't seen it. It's only a hole about an inch and a 1.5 inches to 2 inches big. And my dog has dug out some of the holes and not found anything. But they keep coming back after I pound the holes shut. And they're not anywhere in the yard, which I expected them if they were moles. And they just seem to be riding right around the foundations, and I don't know what they're doing, and I don't like them there.
Barbara, are you seeing tunnels? Are there raised tunnels? Or
yes, there's raised tunnels, but they follow the foundation. Isn't that weird?
Yeah. David?
So if you've got raised tunnels, Barbara, and when you go out into your yard or where these tunnels are, if the soil collapses beneath your foot and that, because of that raised tunnel, then that would be a mole, M-O-L-E. And we've got two mole species in Wisconsin, either the eastern or what's also called the common mole or the star-nosed mole. The eastern mole or the common mole is the more common of the two species, and that's the animal that's found where you have upland, well-drained soil, which it sounds like around your house. So what they're doing, obviously, up there in that area is you probably have some pretty organic cultivated soil. It's easy for them to dig through that soil, so that's one of the reasons they're there.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But they also, one of their primary food sources are earthworms and then also grubs in the soil. And so that you probably have a pretty decent amount of food supply for them in that soil. So there's a couple of things you can do. The easiest thing to do, if you could do this or perhaps somebody in your family or neighborhood could help you do this, if you don't already have a mole trap, get a mole trap, and you want to buy the Harpoon mole trap. And one of the manufacturers of that is a company called Victor Harpoon Trap. It's about $15. You can usually buy them at most hardware stores or outdoor stores. And they've got very explicit directions on the side of that box as to how to set them. And usually, once you've set it, you know, within 12 to 24 hours, you've got that mole. The good news for you is even though you might see a lot of tunnels, usually there's about one mole on average about one for every acre. So even though you see a lot of tunnels, which would indicate probably you've got a lot of moles, you've just got one mole. So that's probably the easiest thing to do is get a Victor harpoon trap. If you don't want to do that, you can also try to reduce the amount of earthworms or grubs in your soil, although that's got some consequences because those earthworms can be very, very good for aerating your soil and things like that.
Yeah, and we need to take a quick a break here. Barbara, thank you so much for calling. I hope you'll follow up on that. Our guests today, David Drake and Jamie Knack from the UW-Madison and UW Extension, they'll be with us right up until 12:30 today here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. News is next. This week marks the fifth year anniversary of the collapse of Lehman Brothers, and Kathleen Dunn and her guests discuss whether we are now economically in the current state of Wall Street. Are we better off? That's today at 1 o'clock here on the Ideas Network. But right now, we are talking with Jamie Knack and David Drake from the UW Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology about enjoying our state's wildlife and certainly inviting you to join in as well. You can phone us at 1-800-642-1234, email us at talk@wpr.org, or post on my Facebook page. Just go to the Larry Mueller Show, and we'd certainly love to have you join in. And Jamie and David, we have an email from Gretchen, who wonders if there are any confirmed sightings of black mountain lions as a color variation in Wisconsin.
So that's following up on our cougar sighting question previously. But again, our cougars that we've documented in the state are part of the Black Hills population, and they're all genetically, as far as I'm aware, going to be the standard sandy brown coloring, long tail, and none of the black variations that you may hear about with pumas and things like that in Florida. So, no, all of ours have been the standard color variation.
I was just going to add on to that, and I agree with Jamie. As I understand, when they do the genetic testing, the cougars, they look for either the North American race or the South American race. And the North American race are those cougars that are coming out of South Dakota, and they're the wild, free-ranging cougars. The South American race is possibly captive cougars that have gotten away or they've been bred. And so you may get some color variation if you get into a South American race because there's more genetic manipulation going on there in captivity and breeding. But other than that, that's the only thing I can think of, Jamie. And I agree with you otherwise.
We have listener Len, by the way, noted on Facebook that Wisconsin small stream trout season closes September 30th. So that's something to keep in mind. That's coming right up. He also posted some really beautiful trout photos to go along with that post, which I'll get up here for us to look at in just a minute. You may want to look at it as well as we visit with our two guests today, David Drake and Jamie Knack. And I wanted to mention, we haven't talked at, we talked about pheasants, and Judith gave us telling us a great story about her learn to hunt experience with pheasants. The DNR has announced it's increasing both numbers of pheasants released in 2013 and locations of the releases.
Yeah, so the past couple of years, there's been stocking levels around about 54,000 birds stocked on about 70 public properties. And this year, that's been expanded. They added another 25,000 birds. So hunters can expect about 75,000 pheasants to be stocked on about 92 public properties. So to handle the distribution of those additional birds, to both increase or sort of evenly distribute hunting pressure, they've added some more properties. So there's been about 20 properties added. And then also the standard properties that have been used in the past, most of those will see an increase in the number of birds throughout the season. So if you're interested in looking at what the stocking levels look like, what properties are available, again, go to the DNR's website and search under the keywords pheasant stocking.
And I was just going to say, Jamie's got a unique observation on this because her husband Bob is in charge of the game farm, at least for a short term, a little while longer now, until he takes on a new responsibility.
Yep, there are changes in the Knack household right now.
And we're gonna have Bob on the show. We got to get a hold of him and have him come on the show and talk about his new role, which is pretty good.
Yeah, he'll be a chief in the Wildlife Bureau and overseeing the new Deer Management Assistance Program, as well as some of the wolf management programs, bears, elk, and so on.
And they picked a very, very good person. Bob is wonderful in everything he does, but he's got the right personality for this new job, and he's going to do, if anybody's going to be successful in this job, Bob will be it.
Yeah, and so we're looking forward to getting him on. We'll get him on soon, I hope. May be able to. Joan in Winter, Wisconsin, we'll be hearing from her in just a minute. But first, let's go to Randy in Linksville. Randy, hi, thank you for calling.
Good afternoon. Hey, thanks for taking my call. I'm really enjoying the program today.
Thank you.
When you guys, when we look at the wolf packs throughout the state, first of all, I'd like to know what the territorial range is for a standard wolf pack. And then, do you know of any wolf packs, how far south they're tracking them? We're in Linksville, and we hear an awful lot of coyotes at night. And just curious if there's any wolf packs that are coming close southward to where we are. I'd like to hang up and listen on the radio if I could.
All right, thank you.
Well, Randy, thanks for the question, and I'm going to divert you to the DNR's website because they do an excellent job of mapping current distribution of packs, so I'm going to be doing it pretty much from memory at this point. I don't have that in front of me. However, the wolf packs are distributed in the northern forests and the central forests of Wisconsin, and occasionally we do see individuals, again, primarily young males, moving south in other parts of the state, but primary wolf range is going to be in the northern and the central forests of the state. But again, if you go to the DNR website, keyword search under wolf, and you'll be able to see the actual territories mapped out by polygons and see where some of those new packs have been established or were first learning that they do exist.
All right. Thank you for calling. Joe in Prairie du Chien. Hi. Thanks for calling.
Good morning or afternoon. I go down to St. Ferial Island in Prairie here by the river behind Villa Louis, a big field out there on the park with my dog in the mornings. Been a lot of Canada geese coming in. This morning there were two small groups, maybe a dozen each. All of a sudden, they all ran together in this little tight bundle. And all of a sudden, a bald eagle swooped by, circled them and flew off. And they went back to spread out again. I found this to be a very interesting defensive mechanism they've learned. And I'm curious, do other geese or swans do this sort of things? I've seen ducks and gulls on the river when the eagles come by, and they just scatter.
Well, one of the things, waterfowl obviously are feel very at home on the water. And so when you're on the water, they are in their habitat, proper habitat, and they feel a lot more comfortable on the water than they do on the land. And one of the issues with those geese being on the land is they don't move quite as quick as they do on the water. And so if you ever watch geese graze, they don't all have their head down at the same time. There's always a couple with their heads up watching what's going on, and they're a herding, you know, animal, and there's safety in numbers. And so one of the reasons that they all herded together as that eagle came through is that it's a lot more difficult for the eagle to pick off one when they're in a group than one when it's out by itself. And so it is a defense mechanism. It's a natural defense mechanism. And one of the reasons you don't see it so much on the water with gulls or ducks and even geese is because they've got a little bit more cover, and they feel more comfortable on the water. However, if an eagle has the opportunity to take a duck off the water, it certainly will.
Oh, yeah.
Very interesting. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. I actually had that. We had that experience. I've told it on the radio before, but we live on Lake Monona, or lived on Lake Monona, and in the spring, there was some open water, but still ice, and there were geese out there, and one of the geese was up on the ice, and an eagle came in and took the...
Yeah.
My wife saw it happen, so it was pretty cool. Eagle ate on the goose for a while, left. It wasn't long before a fox came out and chomped down and ate a bit of the goose, and then a little later, some crows... came down. And this is all right in front of the Monona Terrace.
That's pretty neat.
A few hundred yards out from there. Yep. So it was quite something to see.
Everything's got to eat.
Yep, that's right. And that goose fed a lot of different animals that day.
Right.
It was a fat goose.
Lou Ray in Rosendale. Hi, thanks for calling.
Oh, thank you for taking my call. I want to mention that I love the Larry Mueller's different shows that he has, and especially the wildlife ones.
Thank you.
And I want to preface my comments with I am a permitted wildlife rehabilitator, and I've been a lifelong lover of wildlife, and I wish you would spend more time encouraging your guests to encourage people to live with our native wildlife rather than killing them. I've been disturbed about that element for several years. I listen to you, or to Wisconsin Public Radio every day, all day. And most of the wildlife, native wildlife, can be lived with peacefully if people, you know, can learn more about how to appreciate the wild animals that we have instead of just thinking we've got to kill them.
Yeah.
Like the groundhogs and the moles that you mentioned today. They're basically very harmless, and they're interesting to watch.
Mm-hmm. Well, thanks for calling, Lou Ray. And David Drake, let me turn to you.
Yeah, Lou Ray, I appreciate your perspective and your opinion there. And you're absolutely right that we do need to live with the wildlife to the extent that we can. So when we are talking to people, especially when some negative consequences come up from wildlife-human interactions, we always do try to provide non-lethal solutions as well as lethal solutions to give people options. But certainly from a professional standpoint, we would be amiss or remiss if we did not at least mention that lethal solutions are some of the tools in that toolbox. And again, because people are on their private property, as long as they're abiding by the law and wildlife regulations, that they are free to do as they wish to. And our job is to provide as many different options, fact-based, science-based options as possible, and let the individual decide what is best for them.
And I appreciate, again, your call. Thank you, Lou Ray, for calling. I'm going to give Joan and Winter a chance to join in. Joan, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi, good afternoon. Getting back to cougars, I had probably within the month, maybe 3 weeks, I had a cougar on my patio, and I live in Winter on Lake Loretta, and there's no doubt about what it was. It was like 6-ish in the morning when I woke up and saw this. The thing about it was this animal was swinging its face back and forth, whether it was looking to see if there was anything in back of it or whatever, but the face was white. What do you think about that?
Well, Joan, I have to say, we have learned a long time ago to never say never in terms of wildlife encounters. By the time, you know, we say that, oh, it could never be, a picture's on its way into our email inbox confirming that what they said is indeed what it was. So, you know, the odds of it being a cougar, the straight out odds are, you know, not likely.
Oh, it was a cougar.
Sure.
Oh, there's no doubt about it.
Sure.
They saw the tail and the size of it. And,
yeah.
Oh, yep. Yeah.
So,
oh, yeah.
You know, the things with cougar sightings, what I can say is that it would be very unusual to see that animal again because they are nomadic at this point. They're looking to establish territories. And again, we talked about if they don't find the females within, you know, your area of winter, they're going to move on. So if you see it again, that would make it even a bit more unusual.
Why do you think it had this white face? Do you think it was that old or what?
Well, cougars are pretty much uniformly sandy brown. It's possible just if there was a light on outside or a reflection, the way that you were observing it in the light, it may have appeared more light colored. And I guess the other thing I'll just kind of leave you with is that if you do see something like that and you have a track on your property, whether it's in soft mud or snow, and you have the opportunity to take a photograph of it with maybe a pocket knife or a ruler in the picture so you can document the size of that. You have some kind of scale reference in the photo. That is always really helpful. And if by chance you found any scats or anything like that as you track the animal, that could be collected and reported as well. And just your local biologist would be perhaps interested in hearing about these sightings and being able to come out and try to verify that account.
But my family, because they have dogs, and I called my daughter and I said, get the dogs in. I said, this cougar is on my patio, and I don't know where he's, you know, he's headed. He was not headed that way. He was headed north, like into some of the bush.
Well, you never know, but I would be willing to bet by this time, he is a long ways away from your house, Joan. But what an experience. I was just thinking, I've got my smartphone in my pocket all the time.
Right. Could you get a picture quick?
Yeah.
I'd be pulling that out and trying to get a quick picture, although I must admit, I've tried this, and I'm not taking a picture of a cougar, but other things. And by the time I get my...
sometimes it's better just
to app and, push the right buttons and that. They're
sometimes
gone.
It's better to just savor the moment and take in everything that's going on.
Yep, there we go. We had a Facebook post from Paul. It was a combined garden shed screen room in their yard, which has a poured concrete slab on a gravel base. Just returned home from a long weekend. And something had burrowed under the slab and pushed out much of the gravel under a corner of the slab. We have both raccoon and groundhogs in our area, and we're assuming that the new tenant is probably a groundhog. We talked about evicting before. Can you push the gravel back in place without burying alive whatever was taking up residence?
Well, Paul, if you were to push that gravel back in and the animal's still in the burrow, it will just push that gravel back out, and it's going to become a kind of a seesaw match, and that's a match you're never going to win. So what you really need to do is to remove that animal from the burrow, in essence of Luray's or in honor of Luray's suggestion that we learn to live with wildlife. Gas cartridges are a possibility if you wish to kill that animal. But again, I would be very careful about using the gas cartridge if that burrow is underneath living quarters or someplace where you occupy. Next best choice, again, is to take that trap. And we've got, again, at that wildlifedamage.uwex.edu, we've got a fact sheet on groundhog or woodchuck management, and we talk about trapping there. Once you can get the animal out of the burrow by trapping or some other means, and you're guaranteed that all the animals are out of the burrow, the best thing then is to go find all of those burrow openings and maybe dig down about 6 inches or so backfill the burrow as much as you possibly can with some pea gravel or soil, loose soil, sand, something like that. Dig down about six inches, and then take some chicken wire and put the chicken wire over the hole and then backfill that last 6 inches. And what that does is a lot of times burrowing animals will go and re-burrow into a hole that's been filled in, but that chicken wire prevents them from continuing to dig into that burrow. And at the very least, you have to make them work to side tunnel in so you don't just give it to them. But that's what I would suggest, and give that a shot and see if that doesn't help you.
All right. Holly in Madison, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi, I'm sorry, I might have a bad connection. I appreciate the chicken wire alternative. I agree with the, is it Lee Ray? Mm-hmm. I'm wondering if alternatives for the mole might be to kill the grubs in the yard, and then the moles would disappear. The wildlife specialist said he always offers alternatives. I'm wondering what are some alternatives to get rid of the moles?
Yeah.
Well, Holly, you're absolutely correct. You could put an insecticide down on the lawn, which would, in fact, reduce the number of grubs. And presumably the moles would move on then because the food source has been eliminated. And that is, again, a possibility. When we lay that out as one of the possibilities for mole control, many folks will opt not to choose that because it also eliminates food source for birds. If you think about robins that are feeding in your yard and other bird species. So, again, it is completely up to you what method you choose to take. But that is a method that will work for moles. And some choose to do that and others avoid that method.
Mm-hmm. You can live trap moles if you want to try that. There are some live traps out there. And sometimes you can actually see the mole burrowing or tunneling. And if you can, as you see the animal creating a tunnel, if you take a spade and push the spade in front of the mole and then put a spade behind the mole, you've stopped that animal from going front or backwards. And then you can dig the mole out and relocate it if you wish to do that as well.
Mm-hmm. There we go. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. The DNR is asking hunters in a few counties to help with CWD monitoring. And I don't know if you guys are familiar with that, wondering how that works.
Well, apparently last year in Adams, Juneau, and Portage County, there were three individual deer that tested positive for CWD. And so the DNR wants to increase their surveillance in those areas. And they want to, any deer that is harvested within a radius of 10 miles of where those positive CWD deer were found, they would like any hunter that harvests a deer within that 10-mile radius to submit the deer head for free testing of CWD. And I think it takes, I don't know, 3 or 4 weeks to get the test results back, something like that. And if you go to the DNR's webpage and type CWD into the search engine, it will come up with a surveillance map, and you can figure out the exact location within Adams, Juneau, and Portage County where those positives were. And that will give you a better sense as to if you're hunting within that 10-mile radius to submit your deer head.
And anyone can really have their deer head tested elsewhere, but then we have to pay for it. You have an idea. I can't remember now what the cost, well, basically what the range of cost is for something like that. Do you guys know off the top of your head?
I'm really not sure off the top of my head. And I think within the CWD zone, there are still opportunities to have your deer tested as well. But it's not required anymore.
Yeah, and the opportunities are becoming limited because of funding.
Right.
So, okay. Anyway, something to think about. And I wanted to mention, this is coming up, Pheasant Fest. It's quite a few months off, but that's... We were talking about so much about pheasants today that I did want to mention. I think it's February, like Valentine's Day.
Yeah, 14th through the 16th of 2014, and it's going to be in Milwaukee, I believe. And they're excited about coming back to Wisconsin. Apparently, when they held Pheasant Fest in Madison, maybe in 2009 or so, that they had over 20,000 people. And as a matter of fact, our neighbor went to Pheasant Fest here in Madison and watched the parade of dogs come in, and he got so excited about one of the dog breeds that he went out and bought himself a Munster Launder Small right as soon as Pheasant Fest was over, and that dog Lily is just a wonderful dog next door to us. So
yeah, I guess just to clarify, you know, what is Pheasant Fest? But it's basically a show. It's hosted every year, and it's for upland hunters, but also bird dog owners, landowners. Pheasants Forever is a huge aspect of this Pheasant Fest, and they do a lot with landowners and habitat conservation work on private lands. So you can certainly get those questions asked answered while you're there, and they'll help you on the spot write a conservation plan.
Well, you guys, it's been a lot of fun. I'm sorry we didn't get to everybody with their questions and comments, but David, Jamie, you'll be back.
I think we're back in November again, right?
Back in about
October.
A month or so.
October, yeah. So we'll see you again. Thank you, Larry.
Thank you very much. David Drake and Jamie Knack from the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at UW-Madison and the University of Wisconsin Extension. Great to have them with us. And thank you for listening in today. Tomorrow we're going to hear about the celebration of community cookbooks. That's a little tease for you. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.